WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Coast Guard says at least one crew member has died in the crash of a Navy plane into San Francisco Bay. A second is in extremely critical condition. Two Alameda Naval Air Station aviators ejected from the plane as they hit the water within sight of the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. The Department of Transportation has denied Frank Lorenzo permission to start a new airline. Lorenzo is the former head of Continental and Eastern Airlines. Steve Inskeep of member station WBGO reports.
Frank Lorenzo is the founder of ATX Airlines, a company which wanted to provide low-cost fares along the eastern seaboard. But Lorenzo's long past at the head of troubled airlines caught up with him. In rejecting his company's bid to fly, federal officials say Frank Lorenzo is not competent to run an airline and not inclined to follow safety rules. Lorenzo controlled Continental Airlines as it went into bankruptcy in the early 1980s and controlled Eastern in the late 80s as it suffered through safety violations and labor disputes, and finally went out of business. When he voided union contracts at Continental, Lorenzo became an enemy of organized labor, and his company has claimed the rejection was a political vendetta by airline unions. ATX Airlines is expected to take the federal decision into court. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep in New York.
South African Zulus have defied a state of emergency in Natal province by carrying weapons at a march today. The emergency declaration bans weapons in the province. At least 61 people have died during the last 5 days in political violence. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
Despite last week's ban on the public display of any weapons, Zulus arriving in the northern Natal town of Empangeni today brandished spears and clubs as they gathered under police observation. The march in Empangeni was called by the Zulu nationalist Inkatha Freedom Party, which is boycotting elections scheduled for the end of the month. Inkatha's resistance revived its long-running war with the rival African National Congress and provoked last week's state of emergency declaration. But the deployment of several hundred army troops over the weekend has not yet slowed the carnage. On Friday, Zulu nationalist leaders meet ANC and government representatives to seek a negotiated peace in Natal. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
A Russian government commission has confirmed reports that a Russian airliner crashed last month in Siberia because the pilot's children were in the cockpit. All 75 people aboard died. The officials say the pilot and other crew members were demonstrating how to fly the plane when it veered off course and crashed. On Wall Street today, stock prices have roared back from yesterday's low. The Dow gained more than 82 points to end the day at 3,675.41. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 7-1. This is NPR. Authorities in Columbus, Georgia, say a gasoline spill in the city's sewer system has released dangerously high levels of fumes. Officials are warning that a spark could trigger an explosion and a major fire. Nearly 90 businesses and homes have been evacuated since officials discovered the problem yesterday. Power and natural gas services have been cut off. Hazardous materials teams are going from building to locate the leak. They ventilated the sewer system by removing manhole covers and adding carbon dioxide. The government is recalling 11 brands of crayons because they have lead in them. The crayons are imported from China. NPR's Melinda Penkava reports.
The chairman of the Consumer Product Safety Commission says the crayons should be taken back to the store or thrown away. Ann Brown says three brands in particular have so much lead in them they can give lead poisoning to a child who might eat or chew on them. Lead is especially hazardous to children. It can cause them irreversible brain damage. Those Chinese crayons were distributed by Concord Enterprises, Glory Stationery, and the Toys R Us chain. The other eight brands did not have as much lead in them, but the CSPC warns that eating those crayons over time could increase a child's lead load. Crayons that have been tested for lead have a label that reads, "Conforms to ASTM D4236. However, the CSPC says the Glory Stationery brand also carried that label, along with hazardous levels of lead. I'm Melinda Penkava in Washington.
PLO and Israeli negotiators are working on details of the Palestinian police force. Senior Palestinian officers were expected to go into the occupied territories by now. They're supposed to prepare for an advance unit of several hundred police later this week. But both actions have been held up by disputes at the bargaining table. A senior PLO negotiator says the disputes are on the timing and the weapons distribution. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Frank Rich doesn't think he quite earned the nickname the Butcher of Broadway, but his reviews were said to have the power to make or break a show. For 13 years, he was the chief theater critic for the New York Times. At the beginning of the year, he left the theater beat to write an op-ed column which appears twice weekly in the Times. His column seems to have really caught on. He's written about America's infatuation with celebrity, clashes between blacks and Jews, the hyping of Nancy Kerrigan, and what it's like being a healthy heterosexual in the company of a gay man dying of AIDS. I asked Frank Rich what he thinks of as his new beat.
Well, the great thing about this job is that I don't really have a beat per se. I think there was some idea at the beginning, which is still held to, that I would be looking at that intersection between culture and the news, but not in any kind of dogmatic way, you know, not just looking at direct reflections, but I can do things that are more eccentric and go really wherever my mind takes me.
The assumption was during the years that you were the first string critic that you could either kill a show or make it into a huge success. And I'm wondering how true you think that was and whether the thought of that possibility would weigh on you as you were writing your review, or if that's something you tried not to think about.
Well, first of all, it's part of the mythology of the job. And it was true before I was a Times drama critic. It was true when there were seven newspapers in New York. When I was a kid, Times drama critic is always considered to have this make or break power. It's extremely exaggerated. Of course, occasionally a Times review can make a big difference, pro or con. And there were a couple of examples, but not many during my 13 years. But usually, the shows that are the big hits in New York, that reflects a consensus of opinion. People could say, oh, New York Times, Frank Rich made Guys and Dolls a hit, or made Tommy a hit, or Angels in America a hit. In fact, they got unanimously favorable reviews, or close to it, from all the major newspapers and magazines. So why would the Times be entirely responsible? And the same thing's true with the flops. However, in doing the job, to answer your second question, I always tuned it out because, frankly, as a journalist, that was none of my business. My business was to tell the reader as honestly as I could what I felt about something, and that's who I had in mind, the reader who might have to spend $50 or $100 to see one of these plays and spend an evening there. My heart was with the reader.
When you were reviewing theater, were you self-conscious about that moment when you'd walk into the theater and walk down the aisle, and people were probably turning to each other and saying, "It's Frank Rich, the Times theater critic."
Not terribly. First of all, I don't think I was so recognized until maybe the last couple of years when I started to be more on TV and stuff like that. But I learned to tune it out. It wasn't part of my job. Even when I was fairly unknown, I always knew that the people were planted around me to scream and yell in my ear and say things like, "Gosh, isn't that the greatest performance you've ever seen in your life?" You know, 1 minute after it began.
Were they really planted there?
They really were planted there. I'll never forget taking one of my two sons, who was then quite young, he probably was 9 or 10 years old, to an incredibly dreadful murder mystery that shall remain nameless. It was the first time he came with me when I was reviewing something, and we went to a matinee, and it was supposed to be this funny murder mystery, and it was completely unfunny, and also you could figure out who did it about 15 minutes into the show. Well, behind us, there are couple of men, I'd say, in their early 60s, who are just slapping their legs and screaming with laughter at every silly line. And afterwards, as we're leaving the theater, my son turns to me, and he was this little kid, he says, "Dad, what was going on? Why were those people laughing so much?" And I said, "Well, they were planted there by the management. They're trying to influence the opinion of critics like me." And he said, "But Dad, they were grown-ups. I can't believe they did that." but you know, so that kind of stuff goes on all the time. And you just learn, you learn to tune it out. Similarly, there's a converse to that, which is that sometimes through happenstance, a show postponing its opening several times in such a way that they're letting the critics in at a date they hadn't originally planned on, and the audience, unfortunately for them, in their view, is filled with real people who are not necessarily part of a claque, that audience can be very hostile to a show that you find yourself liking. And you've got to fight the impulse to be influenced by that, too. A classic example is a show where I feel I did make a difference, Stephen Sondheim's Sunday in the Park with George. That show postponed so often, by the time the critics went, they had no choice but to let us go on a theater party night where the audience was very jaded, somewhat elderly, very suburban. It's a very daring show, and there were lots of walkouts and lots of hostile response and tepid response. And yet I was sitting there crying. I was so moved by the show. And so I had learned to tune out that, just as I learned to tune out the false cheers of shows that were not so good.
My guest is Frank Rich. He's the former New York Times theater critic and now writes a column for the Op-Ed page. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Frank Rich, former New York Times theater critic, currently op-ed columnist for the Times. The producer, David Merrick, was alleged to have said about you, "Mr. Rich made many contributions to the American theater, none more great than to leave his post as theater critic." What was between you and David Merrick that would lead him to say such a thing, or to at least have been reputed to say such a thing?
Not much, really. Merrick, the absence of people like David Merrick is really one thing that's hurt the theater very badly. I'm a David Merrick fan. I grew up in his heyday, which had passed really by the time I became a drama critic. There were only a couple of shows that he did during the 13 years I was there. He always had vendettas against the New York Times drama critic, and he would use them to sell his shows. And this was less the case when I was critic, but it was brilliant when I was growing up. You know, he did famous stunts such as take out ads with fake quotes by critics who had the same names as the New York Times drama critics. He baited one of my predecessors by attacking him on the Johnny Carson show for a half hour. Another one, he had distributed his Christmas gift of a supposedly pornographic novel that this critic had written as a young man and was thought to have vanished from the face of the earth. Merrick found every copy, like in a Paris bookstore, and gave it to the entire New York press corps. He was a great showman, and the truth is that I didn't know him, and my fondest memories of him are as a teenager. I took tickets for a lot of his shows, and I thought that was the theater, what the Broadway theater should be. Not that he couldn't be a jerk, and he was, you know, a mean guy, I'm sure, but nonetheless, he did incredible stuff, from, you know, Look Back in Anger and Marat Sade at one extreme to Gypsy and Hello Dolly at the other. I only had him in the tail end of career, and he said that about me because I'm sure I didn't like 42nd Street enough, which is one of the first shows I reviewed and one of the last shows, sadly, that he produced.
There were a couple of almost legendary feuds that you got in during the years that you were theater critic. Without really going into them, I'll say that the things that were said about you include that that there was a personal nastiness sometimes behind what you wrote, and another comment was that you had strongly influenced not only the aesthetic direction of theater but the artistic personnel, the style and content of American theater. How would you respond to both of those things? We'll start first with personal nastiness.
The first thing is easy. I'm not saying that I couldn't be tough, and I could certainly be a very tart writer. I hope I was. But there was nothing personal going on because I didn't know the people I was reviewing. One of the things that that's important to the Times about any of its drama critics or critics in general is that we don't know the people we're reviewing. I didn't go to the Tony Awards. I didn't know David Merrick personally or someone, say, like David Hare, to give an example of someone who took a strong exception to what I wrote about some of his work, although I liked a lot of it. I didn't know David Hare. So, I don't know, I think that's what's always said about bad reviews, no matter who writes them. As far as influencing artistic trends in the theater, I think artists are very independent people and do not, good artists don't write with critics or journalists or anyone, or their, you know, their parents or their spouses or their loved ones tell them to write. I do feel, and I'm proud of the fact, that I champion certain kinds of theater while I was a drama critic. I had a very strong point of view, and, you know, I'm very much stand behind it. And it is true that probably because I extravagantly praised Tony Kushner's Angels in America, to take a handy and recent example, when it was being done in a very small theater, a very small stage, the National Theater in London, it probably did influence the decision of Broadway producers to take a chance on it and bring it to New York at no doubt huge cost, given the length and kind of play it is. Yet, I'm fine about that. I think that art like that needs advocacy, and frankly, I think that if I was the only one who felt that way about Angels in America, it would have failed. And it hasn't failed because obviously it rings a chord with a lot of people. You know, and there are other things I didn't champion. I was not a fan of the musicals of Andrew Lloyd Webber. And
Well, you had a lot of influence there.
I had exactly zero influence, exactly. But, you know, but here's an example of someone who every time I knocked one of his shows, and I didn't knock all of them, and I didn't knock them uniformly, would give out an interview and saying it was a personal attack on him or whatever. I've never met Andrew Lloyd Webber. I just know what I see and hear. And I also, again, as you said, I had no effect there. That's fine, too. I think that the public has to be given credit for knowing its own mind. And if people want Phantom of the Opera, they're going to find it and they're going to embrace it, even if the New York Times critic doesn't like it, which I didn't much.
Just a little sidebar here. When you and the playwright David Hare were disagreeing, Variety had the headline. This was after you had given a bad review to The Secret Rapture and then
right.
It closed. Variety had the headline, Hare airs rich bitch, writer of El Foldo, Rapture, lashes out at New York Times powerful legit critic. I thought, wow.
Well,
what a headline.
I thought it was great. I'm very proud to have had it. I just say two things about that. First of all, it shows how crazy the theater business is. In fact, if you just knew that one incident, you'd think that I had been the sworn enemy of David Hare's writing, when in fact I'd probably been the biggest champion of all of his writing of any critic in America, including, by the way, The Secret Rapture. I just thought it was produced poorly in New York.
You liked the London production.
I liked the London production, but I love the play. The other sidelight about that headline is that Variety doesn't have headlines like that anymore, you know, like Wall Street Lays an Egg and Hicks, Nicks, Sticks, Picks, because of the internationalization, if that's a word, of show business, Variety has sort of stamped out Variety ease. It's now written so it can be understood by the German and the Japanese showbiz mogul, like the Hollywood and Broadway producer. And so they're just really, you don't see headlines like that anymore. So I'm touched that I was the subject of one of the very last ones, if not the last.
I want to ask you a question about reading your own emotions when you're watching theater, television, movies, whatever. Do you ever, for example, find your eyes misting up, and at the same time you're going to go out there and give something a bad review because you don't trust those tears in your eyes? You don't trust the way you're being manipulated by what you're watching?
Generally speaking, no. I feel that you have to go with your instincts. You have to know where those feelings are coming from. Sure, there's sometimes when you can be really, really manipulated, you know, at the end of a schlocky movie, hypothetically.
Even some TV commercials.
TV commercials, you know. Some of those AT&T commercials are pretty touching. But you have to know yourself, and you have to know the difference between that and being profoundly moved when Steven Spinella waves goodbye at the end of Perestroika, or any of a million of other examples I could name. And I think, you know, you have to be ruthless with yourself. But my tendency always is to go with my instinct. If I'm crying, it's probably because it's moving, or at least I find it really moving. I'm not being manipulated. And if I'm laughing, it may be because it's really funny. And it also maybe if I'm yawning, it may not be because I'm tired. It may be because the play is boring. Walter Kerr, a predecessor of mine, who I got to know in later years and sort of an idol of mine when I was learning about drama criticism when I was younger, said to me once, you know, if you think you're sick in the theater, it never is that you're sick. Something is happening on stage. It's making you feel sick. And I thought that was sort of good advice. You have to trust yourself and, you know, have a good sense of who you are and how sometimes your buttons can be pushed for the wrong reasons. But go with it and not be afraid to feel. The greatest thing about theater going is to go there, you know, open to the experience. And who would want to go if you can't do that? You don't go there as a critic, so self-conscious and so conscious of giving grades and different standards that have to be met that you can't have an emotional response. You've got to go there in the same way that you went there as a child, the way I fell in love with theater as a child, which is feeling that curtain's going to go up and anything could happen and I could be, you know, moved to tears or I could be excited or my ideas about some subject could change profoundly because of what's going to happen on that stage. But I don't know what's going to happen until it happens and I've got to be there, really there and part of the experience and ready for it.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Frank Rich is the former chief theater critic for the New York Times. His new op-ed column is published twice weekly in the Times. This is Fresh Air.